Chapter 7. On arriving in Moscow by a morning train, Levin had gone directly to the house of his elder half-brother, Koznishev. After changing his clothes, he went down to his brother's study, intending to talk to him at once about the object of his visit and to ask his advice, but his brother was not alone. With him there was a famous professor of philosophy who had come from Kharkov expressly to clear up a difference that had arisen between them on a very important philosophical question. The professor was carrying on a hot crusade against materialists. Sergei Koznishev had been following this crusade with interest, and after reading the professor's last article, he had written him a letter stating his objections. He accused the professor of making too great concessions to the materialists, and the professor had promptly appeared to argue the matter out. The point in discussion was the question then in vogue: is there a line to be drawn between psychological and physiological phenomena in man, and if so, where? Sergei Ivanovich met his brother with a smile of chilly friendliness he always had for everyone, and introducing him to the professor, he went on with the conversation. A little man in spectacles, with a narrow forehead, tore himself from the discussion for an instant to greet Levin, and then went on talking without paying any further attention to him. Levin sat down to wait for the professor to finish and go, but he soon began to get interested in the subject under discussion. He had come across the magazine articles about which they were disputing, and had read them, interested in them as a development of the first principles of science, familiar to him as a natural science student at the university. But he had never connected these scientific deductions as to the origin of man as an animal, as to reflex action, biology and sociology, with those questions concerning the meaning of life and death to himself, which had of late been more and more often in his mind. As he listened to his brother's argument with the professor, he noticed that they connected these scientific questions with the spiritual, that at times they almost touched on the latter. But every time they came near what seemed to him the chief point, they promptly beat a hasty retreat and plunged again into a sea of subtle distinctions, reservations, quotations, allusions, and appeals to authorities, and it was with difficulty that he understood what they were talking about. "I cannot admit it," said Sergei Ivanovich, with his habitual clarity, precision of expression, and elegance of phrase. "I cannot in any case agree with Keiss that my whole conception of the external world has been derived from perceptions. The most fundamental idea, the idea of existence, has not been received by me through sensation. Indeed, there is no special sense organ for the transmission of such an idea." "Yes, but they, Wurst and Knaust and Pisapov, would answer that your consciousness of existence is derived from the conjunction of all your sensations, that the consciousness of existence is the result of your sensations. Wurst, indeed, says plainly that assuming there are no sensations, it follows that there is no idea of existence."
"I maintain the contrary," said Sergei Ivanovich. But here again it seemed to Levin that just as they were close to the real point of the matter, they were retreating, and he made up his mind to put a question to the professor.
"According to that, if my senses are annihilated, if my body is dead, I can have no existence of any sort?" he queried.
The professor, in annoyance, looking as though the interruption had caused him great suffering, glanced at the strange inquirer, more like a bargeman than a philosopher, and turned his eyes upon Sergei Ivanovich as though to ask, "What's one to say to him?" But Sergei Ivanovich, who'd been talking with far less heat and one-sidedness than the professor, and who had sufficient breadth of mind to answer the professor, and at the same time to comprehend the simple and natural point of view from which the question was put, smiled and said, "That question we have no right to answer as yet."
"We have not the requisite data," chimed in the professor, and he went back to his argument.
"No," he said. "I would point out the fact that if, as Pripasov directly asserts, perception is based on sensation, then we are bound to distinguish sharply between these two conceptions."
Levin listened no more, and simply waited for the professor to go. Chapter 8.
When the professor had gone, Sergei Ivanovitch turned to his brother.
"Delighted that you've come. For some time, is it? How's your farming getting on?"
Levin knew that his elder brother took little interest in farming, and only put the question in deference to him, and so he told him only about the sale of his wheat and money matters. Levin had meant to tell his brother of his determination to get married, and to ask his advice. He had indeed firmly resolved to do so. But after seeing his brother, listening to his conversation with the professor, hearing afterward the unconsciously patronizing tone in which his brother questioned him about agricultural matters, their mother's property had not been divided, and Levin took charge of both their shares. Levin felt that for some reason he couldn't begin to talk to him of his intention of marrying. He felt that his brother wouldn't look at it as he would have wished him to.
"Well, how's your district council doing?" asked Sergei Ivanovitch, who was greatly interested in these local boards and attached great importance to them.
"I really don't know."
"What? Why, surely you're a member of the board?"
"No, I'm not a member now. I've resigned," answered Levin, "and I no longer attend the meetings."
"What a pity," commented Sergei Ivanovitch, frowning.
Levin, defensively, began to describe what took place in the meetings in his district.
"That's how it always is," Sergei Ivanovitch interrupted him. "We Russians are always like that. Perhaps it's our strong point, really, the faculty of seeing our own shortcomings. But we overdo it. We comfort ourselves with irony, which we always have on the tip of our tongues. All I say is, give such rights as our local self-government to any other European people, why, the Germans or the English, would have worked their way to freedom from them, while we simply turn them into ridicule." "But how can it be helped?" said Levin penitently. "It was my last effort. And I did try with all my soul. I can't. I'm no good at it." "It's not that you're no good at it," said Sergei Ivanovitch. "It's that you don't look at it as you should."
"Perhaps not," Levin answered dejectedly.
"Oh, do you know Brother Nikolai's turned up again?"
This Brother Nikolai was the elder brother of Konstantin Levin and half-brother of Sergei Ivanovitch, a man utterly ruined, who had dissipated the greater part of his fortune, was living in the strangest and lowest company, and had quarrelled with his brothers.
"What did you say?"
Levin cried with horror.
"How do you know?" "Prokofy saw him in the street."
"Here, in Moscow? Where is he? Do you know?" Levin got up from his chair as though on the point of starting off at once.
"I'm sorry I told you," said Sergei Ivanovitch, shaking his head at his younger brother's excitement. "I sent to find out where he is living, and sent him his IOU to Trubin, which I paid. This is the answer he sent me."
And Sergei Ivanovitch took a note from under a paperweight and handed it to his brother. Levin read in the strange, familiar handwriting,
"I humbly beg you to leave me in peace. That's the only favour I ask of my gracious brothers. Nikolai Levin."
Levin read it, and without raising his head, stood with the note in his hands opposite Sergei Ivanovitch. There was a struggle in his heart between the desire to forget his unhappy brother for the time, and the awareness that it would be base to do so.
"He obviously wants to offend me," pursued Sergei Ivanovitch, "but he cannot offend me. I would have wished with all my heart to assist him, but I know it's impossible to do that."
"Yes, yes," repeated Levin. "I understand and appreciate your attitude toward him, but I shall go and see him."
"If you want to, do, but I wouldn't advise it," said Sergei Ivanovitch. "As regards myself, I have no fear of your doing so. He will not make you quarrel with me, but for your own sake I think you would do better not to go. You can't do him any good. Still, do as you please."
"Very likely I can't do any good, but I feel, especially at such a moment... But that's another thing. I feel I couldn't be at peace."
"Well, that I don't understand," said Sergei Ivanovitch. "One thing I do understand," he added, "it's a lesson in humility. I have come to look very differently and more charitably on what is called infamy since Brother Nikolai has become what he is. You know what he did."
"Oh, it's awful,"
awful, Levin said.
After obtaining his brother's address from Sergei Ivanovich's footman, Levin was on the point of setting off at once to see him. But on second thought, he decided to put off his visit till the evening. The first thing to do to set his heart at rest was to accomplish what he had come to Moscow for. From his brother's, Levin went to Oblonsky's office, and, on getting news of the Shcherbatskys from him, he drove to the place where he had been told he might find Kitty. Chapter 9. At 4 o'clock, conscious of his throbbing heart, Levin stepped out of a hired sleigh at the Zoological Gardens and turned along the path to the frozen mounds and the skating rink, knowing that he would certainly find her there, as he had seen the Shcherbatskys' carriage at the entrance. It was a bright, frosty day. Rows of carriages, sleighs, cabmen and policemen were standing in the approach. Crowds of well-dressed people with hats bright in the sun swarmed about the entrance and along the well-swept little paths between the little houses, adorned with carving in the Russian style. The old curly birches of the gardens, all their twigs laden with snow, looked freshly decked in festive vestments. He walked along the path toward the skating rink and kept saying to himself, "You mustn't be excited. You must be calm. What's the matter with you? What do you want? Be quiet, stupid," he conjured his heart. And the more he tried to compose himself, the more breathless he found himself. An acquaintance met him and called him by his name, but Levin didn't even recognize him. He went towards the mounds, whence came the clank of the chains of sleighs as they slipped down or were dragged up, the rumble of the sliding sleighs, and the sounds of merry voices. He walked on a few steps, and the skating rink lay open before his eyes. And at once, amidst all the skaters, he knew her. He knew she was there by the rapture and the terror that seized his heart. She was standing talking to a lady at the opposite end of the rink. There was apparently nothing striking either in her dress or her attitude. But for Levin, she was as easy to find in that crowd as a rose among nettles. Everything was made bright by her. She was the smile that shed light on all around her. "Is it possible I can go over there on the ice to go up to her?" he thought. The place where she stood seemed to him a holy shrine, unapproachable, and there was one moment when he was almost retreating, so overwhelmed was he with terror. He had to make an effort to master himself, and to remind himself that people of all sorts were moving about her, and that he, too, might have come there to skate. He walked down, for a long while avoiding looking at her as at the sun, but seeing her as one does the sun, without looking. On that day of the week, and at that time of the day, people of the same set, all acquainted with one another, used to meet on the ice. There were crack skaters there, showing off their skill, and learners clinging to chairs with timid, awkward movements, boys and elderly people skating for their health. They seemed to Levin an elect band of blissful beings because they were here, near her. All the skaters, it seemed, with perfect self-possession, skated toward her, skated by her, even spoke to her, and were happy, quite apart from her, enjoying the wonderful ice and the fine weather. Nikolai Shcherbatsky, Kitty's cousin, in a short jacket and tight trousers, was sitting on a garden seat with his skates on. Seeing Levin, he shouted to him, "Ah, the best skater in Russia! Been here long? Marvellous ice! Put your skates on!" "I haven't got my skates," Levin answered, marvelling at this boldness and ease in her presence, and not for one second losing sight of her, though he didn't look at her. He felt as though the sun were coming near him. She was in a corner, and turning out her slender feet in their high boots with obvious timidity, she skated toward him. A boy in Russian dress, desperately waving his arms and bowed down to the ground, overtook her. She skated a little uncertainly, taking her hands out of the little muff that hung on a cord. She held them ready for emergency, and looking toward Levin, whom she had recognized, she smiled at him, and at her own fears. When she had turned the corner, she gave herself a push off with one foot, and skated straight up to Shcherbatsky. Clutching at his arm, she nodded, smiling to Levin. She was more lovely than he had imagined her. When he thought of her, he could call up a vivid picture of her to himself,
especially the charm of that little fair head, so lightly set on the shapely girlish shoulders, and so full of childish brightness and kindness. The childishness of her expression, together with the delicate beauty of her figure, made up her special charm, and that he fully realized. But what always struck him in her as something unlooked for was the expression of her eyes, soft, serene, and truthful. And above all, her smile, which always transported Levin to an enchanted world, where he felt himself softened and filled with tenderness, as he remembered himself in some days of his early childhood. "Have you been here long?" she said, giving him her hand. "Thank you," she added, as he picked up the handkerchief that had fallen out of her muff.
"I? I've not long... yesterday. I mean today. I arrived," answered Levin in his excitement, not at once understanding her question. "I was meaning to come and see you," he said. And then, recollecting with what intention he was trying to see her, he was promptly overcome with confusion and blushed. "I didn't know you could skate, and skate so well."
She looked at him earnestly, as though wishing to understand the cause of his confusion.
"Your praise is worth having. The tradition here is that you are the best of skaters," she said, with her little black-gloved hand brushing a grain of hoarfrost off her muff.
"Yes, once I used to skate with passion. I wanted to reach perfection."
"You do everything with passion, I think," she said, smiling. "I would so like to see how you skate. Put on skates, and let's skate together."
Skate together? Can that be possible? Thought Levin, gazing at her.
"I'll put them on at once," he said. And he went off to get skates.
"It's a long while since we've seen you here, sir," said the attendant, supporting his foot and screwing on the heel of the skate. "Since you, we've had no gentleman who's so masterful. Will that be all right?" he said, tightening the strap.
"Oh, yes, yes, quickly, please," answered Levin, with difficulty restraining the smile of rapture that would overspread his face. "Yes," he thought, "now this is life, this is happiness."
"Together," she said,
"let us skate together. Speak to her now? But that's just why I'm afraid to speak. Because I'm happy now. Happy in hope, anyway. And then? But I must. I must. I must. Away with weakness." Levin rose to his feet, took off his overcoat, and scurrying over the rough ice around the hut, came out on the smooth ice, and skated without effort. Sheer willpower, as it were, increasing and slackening speed and turning his course. He approached with timidity, but again her smile reassured him. She gave him her hand, and they set off side by side, going faster and faster, and the more rapidly they moved, the more tightly she grasped his hand.
"With you I would soon learn. I somehow feel confidence in you," she said to him.
"And I have confidence in myself when you are leaning on me," he said, but was at once panic-stricken at what he had said, and blushed.
And indeed, no sooner had he uttered these words than all at once, like the sun going behind a cloud, her face lost all its friendliness, and Levin detected the familiar change in her expression that denoted the working of thought. A crease showed on her smooth brow.
"Is there anything troubling you? Though I've no right to ask such a question," he said hurriedly.
"Oh, why so? No, I've nothing to trouble me," she responded coldly, and she added immediately, "You haven't seen Mademoiselle Linon, have you?"
"Not yet."
"Go and speak to her. She likes you so much."
"What's wrong? I've offended her. Lord help me," thought Levin,
and he flew toward the old Frenchwoman with the grey ringlets, who was sitting on a bench. Smiling and showing her false teeth, she greeted him as an old friend.
"Yes, you see we're growing up," she said to him, glancing toward Kitty. "And growing old. Tiny Bear has grown big now," pursued the Frenchwoman, laughing.
And she reminded him of his joke about the three young ladies whom he had compared to the three bears in the English nursery tale.
"Do you remember that's what you used to call them?"
He remembered absolutely nothing, but she had been laughing at the joke for 10 years now, and was fond of it.
"Now, go and skate, go and skate," Our Kitty has learned to skate nicely, hasn't she?"
When Levin darted up to Kitty, her face was no longer stern. Her eyes looked at him with the same sincerity and friendliness, but Levin imagined that in her friendliness there was a certain note of deliberate composure, and he felt depressed. After talking a little of her old governess and her peculiarities, she questioned him about his life.
"Surely you must be bored in the country in the winter, aren't you?" she said.
"No, I'm not bored. I'm very busy," he said, feeling that she was holding him in check by her composed tone, which he would not have the force to break through, just as it had been at the beginning of the winter.
"Are you going to stay in town long?" Kitty questioned him.
"I don't know," he answered, not thinking of what he was saying. He believed that if he was held in check by her tone of quiet friendliness, he would end by going back again without deciding anything, and he resolved to make a struggle against it.
"How is it you don't know?"
"I don't know. It depends upon you," he said, and was immediately horror-stricken at his own words. Whether it was that she had heard his words, or that she didn't want to hear them, she made a sort of stumble, twice struck out, and hurriedly skated away from him. She skated up to Mademoiselle Linon, said something to her, and went toward the pavilion where the ladies took off their skates. "My God, what have I done? Merciful God, help me, guide me," said Levin, praying inwardly. And at the same time, feeling a need of violent exercise, he skated about, describing inner and outer circles. At that moment, one of the young men, the best of the skaters of the day, came out of the coffee-house in his skates with a cigarette in his mouth. Taking a run, he dashed down the steps in his skates, crashing and bounding up and down. He flew down, and without even changing the position of his hands, he skated away over the ice.
"Ah, that's a new trick," said Levin, and he promptly ran up to the top to do this new trick. "Don't break your neck. It takes practice," Nikolai Shcherbatsky shouted after him.
Levin went to the steps, took a run from above as best he could, and dashed down, preserving his balance in this unaccustomed movement with his hands. On the last step he stumbled, but barely touching the ice with his hand, with a violent effort he recovered himself and skated off, laughing.
"How wonderful! How nice he is!"
Kitty was thinking at that moment as she came out of the pavilion with Mademoiselle Linon, and looked toward him with a smile of quiet affection, as though he was a favourite brother.
"And can it be my fault? Can I have done anything wrong? They talk of flirtation. I know it's not he that I love, but still, I am happy with him, and he's so nice. Only, why did he say that?" she mused.
Catching sight of Kitty going away and her mother meeting her at the steps, Levin, flushed from his rapid exercise, stood still and pondered a minute. He took off his skates and overtook the mother and daughter at the entrance of the gardens.
"Delighted to see you," said Princess Shcherbatskaya. "On Thursdays we are at home, as always."
"Today, then?"
"We shall be pleased to see you," the princess said stiffly.
This stiffness hurt Kitty, and she couldn't resist the desire to smooth over her mother's coldness. She turned her head and with a smile said,
"Goodbye till this evening."
At that moment, Stepan Arkadyevitch, his hat cocked on one side with beaming face and eyes, strode into the garden like a conquering hero. But as he approached his mother-in-law, he responded in a mournful and crestfallen tone to her inquiries about Dolly's health. After a little subdued and dejected conversation with his mother-in-law, he threw out his chest again and put his arm in Levin's.
"Well, shall we set off?" he asked. "I've been thinking about you all this time, and I'm very, very glad you've come," he said, looking him in the face with a significant air.
"Yes, come along," answered Levin in ecstasy, hearing unceasingly the sound of that voice saying, "Goodbye till this evening,"
and seeing the smile with which it was said.
"To the Anglia or the Hermitage?"
"I don't mind which."
"All right, then,
the Anglia," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, selecting that restaurant because he owed more there than at the Hermitage, and consequently considered it wrong to avoid it.
"Have you got a sleigh? That's very good, for I sent my carriage home."
The friends hardly spoke all the way. Levin was wondering what that change in Kitty's expression had meant, and alternately assuring himself that there was hope, and falling into despair, seeing clearly that his hopes were insane. And yet all the while he felt himself quite another man, utterly unlike what he had been before her smile and those words, "Goodbye till this evening." Stepan Arkadyevitch was absorbed during the drive in composing the menu of the dinner.
"You like turbot, don't you?"
he said to Levin as they were arriving.
"Eh?" responded Levin. "Turbot? Yes, I'm awfully fond of turbot."
Chapter 10
When Levin went into the restaurant with Oblonsky, he couldn't help noticing a certain peculiarity of expression, as it were, a restrained radiance about the face and whole figure of Stepan Arkadyevitch. Oblonsky took off his overcoat, and with his hat over one ear, walked into the dining room giving directions to the Tartar waiters who were clustered about him in evening coats bearing napkins, bowing to right and to the left to the people he met, and here, as everywhere, joyously greeting acquaintances. He went up to the buffet for a preliminary appetizer of fish and vodka, and said to the painted Frenchwoman decked in ribbons, lace, and ringlets behind the counter something so amusing that even she was moved to genuine laughter. Levin, for his part, refrained from taking any vodka simply because he felt such a loathing of that Frenchwoman, all made up, it seemed, of false hair, poudre de riz, and vinaigre de toilette. He made haste to move away from her, as from a dirty place. His whole soul was filled with memories of Kitty, and there was a smile of triumph and happiness shining in his eyes.
"This way, Your Excellency, please. Your Excellency won't be disturbed here," said a particularly pertinacious white-headed old Tartar, with immense hips and coat-tails gaping widely behind. "Walk in, Your Excellency," he said to Levin, by way of showing his respect to Stepan Arkadyevitch, being attentive to his guest as well.
Instantly flinging a fresh cloth over the round table under the bronze chandelier, though it already had a tablecloth on it, he pushed up velvet chairs and came to a standstill before Stepan Arkadyevitch, with a napkin and a menu in his hands, awaiting his orders.
"If you prefer it, Your Excellency, a private room will be free very soon. Prince Golitsyn with a lady. Fresh oysters have come in." "Ah, oysters!"
Stepan Arkadyevitch became thoughtful.
"What if we were to change our plans, Levin?" he said, keeping his finger on the menu, and his face expressed serious hesitation. "Are the oysters good? Absolutely." "They're Flensburg, Your Excellency. We've no Ostend." "Flensburg will do, but are they fresh? Only arrived yesterday." "Well, then, what if we were to begin with oysters and so change the whole menu, eh?"
"It's all the same to me. I would like cabbage soup and kasha better than anything, but of course there's nothing like that here."
"Kasha à la Russe, Your Honour would like," said the Tartar, bending down to Levin like a nurse speaking to a child. "No, joking aside, whatever you choose is sure to be good. I've been skating and I'm hungry. And don't imagine," he added, detecting a look of dissatisfaction on Oblonsky's face, "that I won't appreciate your choice. I'm fond of good things."
"I should hope so. After all, it's one of the pleasures of life," said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"Well then, my friend, you give us 2, better say 3 dozen oysters, clear soup with vegetables."
"Printanière," prompted the Tartar. But Stepan Arkadyevitch apparently didn't care to allow him the satisfaction of giving the French names of the dishes.
"With vegetables in it, you know. Then turbot with thick sauce, then roast beef.
And be sure it's good. Yes, and capons, perhaps. And then preserved fruit."
The Tartar, recollecting that it was Stepan Arkadyevitch's way not to call the dishes by the names in the French menu, didn't repeat them after him, but couldn't resist rehearsing the whole menu to himself according to the bill. "Soupe printanière, turbot, sauce bon marché, poularde à l'estragon, macédoine de fruits, etc." And then instantly, as though worked by springs, laying down one bound menu, he took up another, the list of wines, and submitted it to Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"What shall we drink?"
"What you like, only not too much. Champagne," said Levin.
What, to start with?
You're right, though. Why not? Do you like the white seal?
Cachet blanc, prompted the Tartar.
Very well, then give us that brand with the oysters, and then we'll see.
Yes, sir. And what table wine?
You can give us Nuit.
Oh, no. Better the classic Chablis.
Yes, sir. And your cheese, Your Excellency.
Oh, yes, Parmesan. Or would you like another?
No, it's all the same to me, said Levin, unable to suppress a smile.
And the Tartar ran off with flying coattails, 5 minutes later darting back with a dish of opened oysters on mother-of-pearl shells and a bottle between his fingers. Stepan Arkadyevitch crushed the starchy napkin, tucked it into his vest, and settling his arms comfortably, started on the oysters.
Not bad, he said, stripping the oysters from the pearly shells with a silver fork and swallowing them one after another.
Not bad, he repeated, turning his dewy, brilliant eyes from Levin to the Tartar.
Levin ate the oysters, though white bread and cheese would have pleased him better. But he was admiring Oblonsky. Even the Tartar, uncorking the bottle and pouring the sparkling wine into the thin, wide glasses, glanced at Stepan Arkadyevitch and settled his white cravat with a perceptible smile of satisfaction.
"You don't care much for oysters, do you?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch, emptying his wine glass. "Or you're worried about something, eh?"
He wanted Levin to be in good spirits. But it wasn't that Levin was not in good spirits. He was ill at ease. With what he had in his soul, he felt sore and uncomfortable in the restaurant, in the midst of private rooms where men were dining with ladies, in all this fuss and bustle. The surroundings of bronzes, mirrors, gaslights, and waiters, all of it was offensive to him. He was afraid of sullying what his soul was imbued with.
"I? Yes, I am. But besides, all this bothers me," he said. "You can't conceive how strange it all seems to a country person like me. As strange as that gentleman's nails I saw at your place."
"Yes, I saw how much interested you were in poor Grinevich's nails," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, laughing.
"It's all too much for me," responded Levin.
"Do try and put yourself in my place. Take the point of view of a country person. We in the country try to have our hands in such condition as will be most convenient for working with. So we cut our nails. Sometimes we turn up our sleeves. And here, people purposely let their nails grow as long as they will, and put on small saucers for cufflinks, so that they can do nothing with their hands."
Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled gaily.
"Oh yes, that's just a sign that he has no need to do coarse work. His work is with his mind.
Maybe. But still it's strange to me, just as at this moment it seems strange to me that we country folks try to get our meals over with as soon as we can, so as to be ready for our work. While here, we are trying to drag out our meal as long as possible, and with that object, eating oysters."
"Why, of course," objected Stepan Arkadyevitch. "But that's just the aim of civilization, to make everything a source of enjoyment."
"Well, if that's its aim, I'd rather be a savage."
"And so you are a savage. All you Levins are savages."
Levin sighed. He remembered his brother Nikolai, and felt ashamed and distressed, and he scowled. But Oblonsky began speaking of a subject that at once drew his attention.
"Oh, are you going tonight to our people, the Shishchabatskys, I mean?" he said, his eyes sparkling significantly, as he pushed away the empty rough shells and drew the cheese toward him.
"Yes, I shall certainly go," replied Levin, "though I thought the princess was not very warm in her invitation."
"What nonsense! That's her manner. Come, boy, the soup! That's her manner, grande dame," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "I'm coming too, but I have to go to the Countess Barnina's rehearsal." "Come, isn't it true that you're a savage? How do you explain the sudden way in which you vanished from Moscow? The Shishchabatskys were continually asking me about you, as though I ought to know. The only thing I know is that you always do what no one else does."
"Yes," said Levin, slowly and with emotion. "You're right. I am a savage. Only my savageness is not in having gone away, but in coming now. Now I have come.
"Oh, what a lucky fellow you are," Stepan Arkadyevitch broke in, looking into Levin's eyes.
"Why?"
"I recognize the lively steeds by their brands, and I recognize young lovers by their eyes," he declaimed. "Everything is before you."
"Why, is it over for you already?"
"No, not over exactly, but the future is yours, and the present is mine, and the present... well, it's not all that it might be."
"How so?"
"Oh, things go wrong. But I don't want to talk of myself, and besides, I can't explain it all," said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "Well, why have you come to Moscow, then? Take this away," he called to the Tartar.
"You guess?" Levin asked, his eyes like deep wells of light fixed on Stepan Arkadyevitch.
"I guess, but I can't be the first to talk about it." "You can see by that whether I guess right or wrong," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, gazing at Levin with a subtle smile.
"Well, and what have you to say to me?" said Levin in a quivering voice, feeling that all the muscles of his face were quivering too.
"How do you look at the question?"
Stepan Arkadyevitch slowly emptied his glass of Chablis, never taking his eyes off Levin.
"I?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "There's nothing I desire so much as that. Nothing. It would be the best thing that could be."
"But you're not making a mistake. You know what we're speaking of," said Levin, piercing him with his eyes.
"You think it's possible?"
"I think it's possible. Why not possible?"
"No. Do you really think it's possible? No, tell me all you think. Oh, but if...
if refusal's in store for me.
Indeed, I feel sure..."
"Why should you think that?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling at his excitement.
"It seems so to me sometimes, that will be awful for me and for her too."
"Oh, well, anyway, there's nothing awful in it for a girl. Every girl's proud of a proposal."
"Yes, every girl, but not she."
Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled. He so well knew that feeling of Levin's, that for him all the girls in the world were divided into two classes. One class, all the girls in the world except her, those with all sorts of human weaknesses, ordinary. The other class, she alone, having no weakness of any sort, and higher than all humanity.
"Wait, take some sauce," he said, holding back Levin's hand as it pushed away the sauce.
Levin obediently helped himself to sauce, but would not let Stepan Arkadyevitch go on with his dinner.
"No, stop a minute," he said.
"You must understand that it's a question of life and death for me. I've never spoken to anyone of this, and there's no one I could speak of it to except you. You know, we're utterly unlike each other, different tastes and views and everything. But I know you're fond of me, and understand me, and that's why I like you so much. But for God's sake, be quite straightforward with me."
"I'll tell you what I think," said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling. "But I'll say more. My wife's a wonderful woman." Stepan Arkadyevitch sighed, remembering his position with his wife, and after a moment's silence resumed, "She has a gift of foreseeing things. She sees right through people, but that's not all. She knows what will come to pass, especially in the way of marriages. She foretold, for instance, that Princess Shahovskaya would marry Brenteln. No one would believe it, but it came to pass. And she's on your side."
"How do you mean?"
"It's not only that she likes you. She says that Kitty is certain to be your wife."
At these words, Levin's face suddenly lighted up with a smile, a smile not far from tears of emotion.
"She says that," cried Levin.
"I always said she was exquisite, your wife. There, that's enough. Enough said about it," he said, getting up from his seat.
"All right, but do sit down."
But Levin couldn't sit down. He strode up and down the little cage of a room, blinking his eyelids that his tears might not fall, and only then sat down at the table.
"You must understand," said he. "It's not love. I've been in love, but it's not that. It's not my feeling, but a sort of force outside me has taken possession of me. I went away, you see, because I made up my mind that it could never be, you understand, as a happiness that does not come on earth.
but I've struggled with myself. I see there's no living without it, and it must be settled. What did you go away for? Oh, stop a minute. Ah, the thoughts that come crowding on one, the questions one must ask oneself. Listen, you can't imagine what you've done for me by what you said. I'm so happy that I've become positively disgusting. I've forgotten everything. I heard today that my brother Nikolai, you know, he's here. I'd even forgotten him. It seems to me that he's happy too. It's a sort of madness. But one thing's awful. Here, you've been married, you know the feeling. It's awful that we, old, with past, not of love, but of sins, are brought all at once so near to a creature pure and innocent. Well, it's loathsome, and that's why one can't help feeling oneself unworthy. Oh, well, you've not many sins on your conscience. Alas, all the same, said Levin. When with loathing I go over my life, I shudder and curse and bitterly complain. Yes. What can one do? The world's made like that, said Stepan Arkadyevitch. The one comfort is like that prayer which I always liked. Forgive me not according to my unworthiness, but according to thy loving kindness. That's the only way she can forgive me. Chapter 11 Levin emptied his glass, and they were silent for a while.
There's one other thing I ought to tell you.
Do you know Vronsky? Stepan Arkadyevitch asked Levin.
No, I don't.
Why do you ask?
Give us another bottle, Stepan Arkadyevitch directed the Tartar, who was filling up their glasses and fidgeting around them just when he was not wanted. Why, you ought to know Vronsky,
because he's one of your rivals. Who's Vronsky? Said Levin, and his face was suddenly transformed from the look of childlike ecstasy which Oblonsky had just been admiring to an angry and unpleasant expression.
Vronsky is one of the sons of Count Kirill Ivanovich Vronsky, and one of the finest specimens of the gilded youth of Petersburg. I made his acquaintance in Tver when I was there on official business, and he came there for the levy of recruits. Very rich, handsome, great connections, an aide-de-camp, and with all that a very nice, good-natured fellow. But he's more than simply a good-natured fellow, as I found out here. He's a cultivated man, too, and very intelligent. He's a man who'll make his mark.
Levin scowled and was silent.
Well, he turned up here soon after you'd gone, and as far as I can see, he's head over heels in love with Kitty. And you know that her mother... Excuse me, but I know nothing, said Levin, frowning gloomily. And immediately he recollected his brother Nikolai, and how loathsome he was to have been able to forget him. Wait a minute, said Stepan Arkadyevitch, smiling and touching his hand. I've told you what I know, and I repeat that in this delicate and tender matter, as far as one can judge, I believe the chances are in your favour.
Levin dropped back in his chair. His face was pale.
But I would advise you to settle the thing as soon as possible, Oblonsky went on, filling up his glass.
No, thanks, I can't drink any more, said Levin, pushing away his glass.
I shall be drunk.
Come, tell me. How are you getting on? He said, obviously anxious to change the conversation.
One word more. In any case, I advise you to settle the question soon.
Tonight I don't advise you to speak, said Stepan Arkadyevitch.
Go round tomorrow morning, make an offer in due form, and God bless you. Oh, are you still thinking of coming down for some shooting? Come next spring, said Levin.
Now his whole soul was full of remorse that he had begun this conversation with Stepan Arkadyevitch. A feeling such as his was profaned by talk of the rivalry of some Petersburg officer, of the suppositions and the counsels of Stepan Arkadyevitch. Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled. He knew what was going on in Levin's soul.
"I'll come some day," he said. "But women, me boy, they're the pivot everything turns upon. Things are in a bad way with me, very bad, and it's all through women. Tell me frankly now,"
he pursued, picking up a cigar and keeping one hand on his glass. "Give me your advice." "Why, what is it?"
"I'll tell you. Suppose you're married. You love your wife, but you're fascinated by another woman. Excuse me, but I'm absolutely unable to comprehend how, just as I can't comprehend how I could now, after my dinner, go straight to a baker's shop and steal a roll."
Stepan Arkadyevitch's eyes sparkled more than usual.
"Why not? Rolls will sometimes smell so good one can't resist 'em. It is heavenly whenever I mastered my earthly desire, but whenever I didn't succeed, I still took my pleasure."
As he said this, Stepan Arkadyevitch smiled subtly. Levin, too, couldn't help smiling.
"Yes, joking aside," Stepan Arkadyevitch resumed, "you must understand that the woman is a sweet, gentle, loving creature, poor and lonely, and has sacrificed everything. Now, when the thing's done, don't you see, can one possibly cast her off? Even supposing one parts from her so as not to break up one's family life, still, can one help feeling for her? Setting her on her feet, softening her position? Well, you must excuse me there. You know, to me, all women are divided into two classes. At least, no... truer to say, there are women and there are... I've never seen exquisite fallen beings, and I never shall see them, but such creatures as that painted Frenchwoman at the counter with the ringlets are vermin to my mind, and all fallen women are the same. But the Magdalene? Oh, drop that. Christ never would have said those words if he had known how they would be abused. Of all the gospel, those words are the only ones remembered. However, I'm not saying so much what I think as what I feel. I have a loathing for fallen women. You are afraid of spiders, and I of these vermin. Most likely you've not made a study of spiders and don't know their character, and so it is with me." "It's very well for you to talk like that. It's very much like that gentleman in Dickens who used to fling all difficult questions over his right shoulder with his left hand. But to deny the facts is no answer. What's to be done? You tell me that. What's to be done? Your wife gets older while you're full of life. Before you've time to look around, you feel that you can't love your wife with love, however much you may esteem her. And then all at once love turns up and you're done for. Done for," Stepan Arkadyevitch said with weary despair. Levin half smiled. "Yes, you're done for," Oblonsky repeated. "But what's to be done?" "Don't steal rolls." Stepan Arkadyevitch laughed outright. "Oh, moralist! But you must understand there are two women. One insists only on her rights, and those rights are your love, which you can't give her, and the other sacrifices everything for you and asks for nothing. What are you to do? How are you to act? There's a fearful tragedy in it." "If you care for my profession of faith as regards that, I'll tell you that I don't believe there was any tragedy about it. And this is why. To my mind, love, both kinds of love, which you remember Plato defines in his Symposium, serve as the test of men. Some men understand only one kind, and some only the other. And those who know only the non-Platonic love have no need to talk of tragedy. In such love there can be no tragedy. I'm much obliged for the gratification, my humble respects. That's the whole tragedy. And in Platonic love there can be no tragedy, because in that love all is clear and pure, because..." At that instant, Levin recollected his own sins and the inner conflict he had lived through, and he added unexpectedly, "But perhaps you're right. Very likely. I don't know. I don't know." "It's this, don't you see?" said Stepan Arkadyevitch. "You're very much all of a piece. That's your strong point, and your failing. You have a character that's all of a piece, and you want the whole of life to be of a piece too. But that's not how it is. You despise public official work because you want the reality to be invariably corresponding all the while with the aim. And that's not how it is.
You want a man's work, too, always to have a defined aim, and love and family life always to be undivided. And that's not how it is. All the variety, all the charm, all the beauty of life is made up of light and shadow.
Levin sighed and made no reply. He was thinking of his own affairs and didn't hear Oblonsky. And suddenly, both of them felt that though they were friends, though they had been dining and drinking together, which should have drawn them closer, each was thinking only of his own affairs, and they had nothing to do with one another. Oblonsky had more than once experienced this extreme sense of aloofness instead of intimacy, coming on after dinner, and he knew what to do in such cases.
"Bill!" he called, and went into the next room, where he promptly came across an aide-de-camp of his acquaintance, and fell into conversation with him about an actress and her protector.
And at once, in the conversation with the aide-de-camp, Oblonsky had a sense of relaxation and relief after the conversation with Levin, which always put him to too great a mental and spiritual strain. When the Tartar appeared with a bill for 26 rubles and odd kopecks, beside a tip for himself, Levin, who, like anyone from the country, would another time have been horrified at his share of 14 rubles, didn't notice it, paid, and set off homeward to dress and go to the Shishchabatskys, there to decide his fate. Chapter 12. The young Princess Kitty Shishchabatskaya was 18. It was the first winter that she had been out in the world. Her success in society had been greater than that of either of her elder sisters, and greater even than her mother had anticipated. To say nothing of the young men who danced at the Moscow balls, almost all being in love with Kitty, two serious suitors had already this first winter made their appearance, Levin, and immediately after his departure, Count Vronsky. Levin's appearance at the beginning of the winter, his frequent visits and evident love for Kitty, had led to the first serious conversations between Kitty's parents as to her future, and to disputes between them. The prince was on Levin's side. He said he wished for nothing better for Kitty. The princess, for her part, approaching the question in the manner peculiar to women, maintained that Kitty was too young, that Levin had done nothing to prove that he had serious intentions, that Kitty felt no great attraction to him, and other side issues. But she didn't state the principal point, which was that she looked for a better match for her daughter, and that Levin was not to her liking, and that she didn't understand him. When Levin had abruptly departed, the princess was delighted and said to her husband triumphantly, "You see, I was right." When Vronsky appeared on the scene, she was still more delighted, confirmed in her opinion that Kitty was to make not simply a good, but a brilliant match. In the mother's eyes, there could be no comparison between Vronsky and Levin. She disliked in Levin his strange and uncompromising opinions and his shyness in society, founded, as she supposed, on his pride and his peculiar sort of life, as she considered it, absorbed in cattle and peasants. She didn't very much like it that he, who was in love with her daughter, had kept coming to the house for 6 weeks, as though he were waiting for something, inspecting, as though he were afraid he might be doing them too great an honour by making an offer, and didn't realize that a man who continually visits at a house where there is a young unmarried girl is bound to make his intentions clear. And suddenly, without doing so, he disappeared.
"It's good that he's not attractive enough for Kitty to have fallen in love with him," thought the mother.
Vronsky satisfied all the mother's desires. Very wealthy, clever, of aristocratic family, on the high road to a brilliant career in the army and at court, and a fascinating man. Nothing better could be wished for. Vronsky openly flirted with Kitty at balls, danced with her, and came continually to the house. Consequently, there could be no doubt of the seriousness of his intentions. But in spite of that, the mother had spent the whole of that winter in a state of terrible anxiety and agitation. Princess Shishchabatskaya herself had been married 30 years ago, her aunt arranging the match. Her husband, about whom everything was well known beforehand, had come, looked at his future bride, and been looked at. The matchmaking aunt had ascertained and communicated their mutual impression. That impression had been favourable. Afterward, on a day fixed beforehand,
the expected offer was made to her parents and accepted. All had passed very simply and easily, so it seemed at least to the princess. But over her own daughters, she had felt how far from simple and easy is the business, apparently so commonplace, of marrying off one's daughters. The panics that had been lived through, the thoughts that had been brooded over, the money that had been wasted, and the disputes with her husband over marrying the two elder girls, Daria and Natalia. Now, since the youngest had come out, she was going through the same terrors, the same doubts and quarrels with her husband, still more violent than those over the older girls. The old prince, like all fathers indeed, was exceedingly punctilious on the score of the honour and reputation of his daughters. He was irrationally jealous over his daughters, especially over Kitty, who was his favourite. At every turn he had scenes with the princess for compromising her daughter. The princess had grown accustomed to this already with her other daughters, but now she felt that there was more ground for the prince's touchiness. She saw that of late years much was changed in the manners of society, that a mother's duties had become still more difficult. She saw that girls of Kitty's age formed some sort of clubs, went to some sort of lectures, mixed freely in men's society, drove about the streets alone. Many of them didn't curtsy. And, what was the most important thing, all the people were firmly convinced that to choose their husband was their own affair, and not their parents'. "Marriages aren't made nowadays as they used to be," was thought and said by all these young girls, and even by their elders. But how marriages were made now, the princess could not learn from anyone. The French fashion, of the parents arranging their children's future, was not accepted. It was condemned. The English fashion, of the complete independence of girls, was also not accepted, and not possible in Russian society. The Russian fashion of matchmaking by the officer of intermediate persons was, for some reason, considered disgraceful. It was ridiculed by everyone, and by the princess herself. But how girls were to be married, and how parents were to marry them, no one knew. Everyone with whom the princess had chanced to discuss the matter said the same thing.
"It's high time, in our day, to cast off all that old-fashioned business. It's the young people who have to marry, and not their parents, and so we ought to leave the young people to arrange it as they choose." It was very easy for anyone to say that who had no daughters, but the princess realized that in the process of getting to know various men, her daughter might fall in love, and fall in love with someone who didn't care to marry her, or who was quite unfit to be her husband. And however much it was instilled into the princess that in our times young people ought to arrange their lives for themselves, she was unable to believe it, just as she would have been unable to believe that at any time whatever the most suitable playthings for children 5 years old ought to be loaded pistols. And so the princess was far more uneasy over Kitty than she had been over her elder daughters. Now she was afraid that Vronsky might confine himself to simply flirting with her daughter. She saw that her daughter was in love with him, but tried to comfort herself with the thought that he was an honourable man and wouldn't do this. But at the same time she knew how easy it is, with the freedom of manners of today, to turn a girl's head, and how lightly men generally regard such a crime. The week before, Kitty had told her mother of a conversation she had had with Vronsky during a mazurka. This conversation had partly reassured the princess, but perfectly at ease she could not be. Vronsky had told Kitty that both he and his brother were so used to obeying their mother that they never made up their minds to any important undertaking without consulting her. "And just now I am awaiting my mother's arrival from Petersburg as a supreme blessing," he told her. Kitty had repeated this without attaching any significance to the words, but her mother saw them in a different light. She knew that the old lady was expected from day to day, that she would be pleased at her son's choice, and she felt it strange that he should not make his offer through fear of vexing his mother. However, she was so anxious for the marriage itself, and still more for relief from her fears, that she believed it was so. Bitter as it was for the princess to see the unhappiness of her eldest daughter, Dolly, on the point of leaving her husband, her anxiety over the decision of her youngest daughter's fate engaged all her feelings. Today, with Levin's reappearance, a fresh source of anxiety arose. She was afraid that her daughter, who had at one time, she thought, a feeling for Levin, might, from extreme sense of honour, refuse Vronsky,
and that Levin's arrival might generally complicate and delay the affair so near being concluded.
"Why, has he been here long?" the princess asked about Levin as they returned home.
"He came today, Mama."
"There's one thing I want to say," the princess began, and from her serious and alert face Kitty guessed what it would be.
"Mama," she said, flushing hotly and turning quickly to her, "please, please don't say anything about that.
I know all about it." She wished for what her mother wished for, but the motives of her mother's wishes wounded her.
"I only want to say that to raise hopes..."
"Mama, darling, for goodness sake, don't talk about it. It's so horrible to talk about it."
"I won't," said her mother, seeing the tears in her daughter's eyes. "But one thing, my love, you promised me you would have no secrets from me. You won't?"
"Never, Mama, none," answered Kitty, flushing a little, and looking her mother straight in the face. "But there's no use in my telling you anything, and if I wanted to, I don't know what to say or how. I don't know."
"No, she couldn't tell an untruth with those eyes," thought the mother, smiling at her agitation and happiness. Smiling, because what was taking place just now in her daughter's soul seemed to the poor child so immense and so important.
Chapter 13. After dinner, until the beginning of the evening, Kitty was feeling a sensation akin to that of a young man before a battle. Her heart throbbed violently, and she couldn't fix her thoughts on anything. She felt that this evening, when they would meet each other for the first time, would be a turning point in her life, and she was continually picturing them to herself, at one moment each separately, and then both together. When she mused on the past, she dwelled with pleasure, with tenderness, on the memories of her relations with Levin. The memories of childhood and of Levin's friendship with her dead brother gave a special poetic charm to her relations with him. His love for her, of which she felt certain, was flattering and delightful to her, and it was pleasant for her to think of Levin. In her memories of Vronsky, there always entered a certain element of awkwardness, though he was in the highest degree well-bred and poised, as though there was some false note, not in Vronsky, he was very simple and nice, but in herself, while with Levin she felt perfectly at ease. But on the other hand, as soon as she thought of the future with Vronsky, there arose before her a perspective of brilliant happiness. With Levin the future seemed misty. When she went upstairs to dress and looked into the mirror, she noticed with joy that it was one of her good days, and that she was in complete possession of all her powers. She needed this so, for what lay before her. She was conscious of external composure and free grace in her movements. At 7:30 she had just gone down into the drawing-room, when the footman announced, "Konstantin Dmitrievich Levin." The princess was still in her room, and the prince hadn't come in. "So it is to be," thought Kitty, and all the blood seemed to rush to her heart. She was horrified at her paleness as she glanced into the mirror. At that moment she knew beyond doubt that he had come early on purpose to find her alone and to propose to her. And then, for the first time, the whole thing presented itself in a new, different aspect. Only then did she realize that the question did not affect her only, with whom she would be happy and whom she loved, but that she would that moment have to wound a man whom she liked, and to wound him cruelly. What for? Because he, dear fellow, loved her, was in love with her. But there was no help for it. So it must be. So it would have to be. "My God, must I really have to say it to him?" she thought. "Can't I tell him I don't love him? That will be a lie. What am I to say to him? That I love someone else? No, that's impossible. I'm going away. I'm going away." She had reached the door when she heard his step. "No, it's not fair. What have I to be afraid of? I've done nothing wrong. What is to be, will be. I'll tell the truth. And with him one can't be ill at ease. "Here he is," she said to herself, seeing his powerful, shy figure with his shining eyes fixed on her. She looked straight into his face as though imploring him to spare her, and gave him her hand.
"It's not time yet. I think I'm too early," he said, glancing around the empty drawing room. When he saw that his expectations were realized, that there was nothing to prevent him from speaking, his face became gloomy.
"Oh, no," said Kitty, and sat down at the table.
"But this was just what I wanted, to find you alone," he began, not sitting down, and not looking at her, so as to keep up his courage.
"Mama will be down right away. She was very tired. Yesterday..."
She talked on, not knowing what her lips were uttering, and not taking her supplicating and caressing eyes off him. He glanced at her. She blushed and ceased speaking.
"I told you I didn't know whether I would be here long, that it depended on you."
She bent her head lower and lower, not knowing herself what answer she would make to what was coming.
"That it depended on you," he repeated. I meant to say,
"I came for this.
To be my wife," he brought out, not knowing what he was saying, but feeling that the most terrible thing was said. He stopped short and looked at her. She was breathing heavily, not looking at him. She was feeling ecstasy. Her soul was flooded with happiness. She had never anticipated that the utterance of love would produce such a powerful effect on her. But it lasted only an instant. She remembered Vronsky. She lifted her clear, truthful eyes, and seeing his desperate face, she answered hastily, "That cannot be. Forgive me." A moment ago, and how close she had been to him, of what importance in his life, and how aloof and remote from him she had become now.
"It was bound to be so," he said, not looking at her.
And bowing, he prepared to leave.